You're listening to HuntertonChamberRadio.com, sponsored by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. Our studios are located in the CenturyLink building at 14 Mine Street, Flemington, New Jersey. The content and views of our hosts do not necessarily reflect the views of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. To contact our station, call 908-782-7115 or email onair@hunterdon-chamber.org. Thank you to our sponsors and underwriters. Please remember to support them and buy Hunterdon, buy local. Visit www.hunterdonchamberradio.com for a complete listing of our programming.
Political expert Larry Sabato believes things will change drastically in the Republican presidential field once the calendar turns to 2016.
Once we get into the new year and the voting actually starts and you have reactions from the results in Iowa and then reactions from the results in New Hampshire and South Carolina and Nevada and on, you shake up the field.
The director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics tells Fox News that when voting actually begins, things will change with such a large roster of candidates. Sabato adds that whoever the GOP nominee eventually is, they're likely to face former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Sabato doesn't believe Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders has what it takes to earn the Democratic nomination. The White House is introducing a plan to help people who've served their debt to society to rejoin it. President Obama will outline plans today that include as much as $8 million in federal education grants. You're listening to USA Radio News. I'm Melody Burkett.
Individuals and businesses with tax problems, listen carefully. If you owe over $10,000 in back taxes or have unfiled tax returns, U.S. Tax Shield can help you take back control. The IRS can seize your bank accounts, garnish your paycheck, close your business, and file criminal charges. Our team of tax attorneys can stop collections and get you protected. U.S. Tax Shield offers a price protection guaranteed quote to get you protected today. U.S. Tax Shield is A-plus rated with the BBB, so call 800-479-2697. U.S. Tax Shield, 800-479-2697.
A pro-Israel activist was in Memphis Sunday discussing how both Jews and Christians could be on the lookout for anti-Semitism in the classroom. USA's Russ Jones was at the event and has more.
Lori Cardoza Moore, president of Proclaiming Justice to the Nations, tells USA News that school textbooks are historically inaccurate, biased, and do not reflect the Judeo-Christian values that this country was founded upon.
These textbooks and instructional materials violate the Establishment Clause of the U.S. Constitution.
Cardoza Moore contends many clearly favor the establishment of one religion, namely Islam.
We are finding textbooks that are promoting the Shahada prayer, teaching our children how to pray the Shahada prayer, teaching our children how to make prayer rugs. These textbooks are unacceptable. They are undermining the future of our country, and we as parents and citizens have to stand up and say, no more, not on my watch.
Parents are encouraged to check sections on comparative religions or the Middle East to ensure accuracy or look for anti-Semitic perspectives. In Memphis, I'm Russ Jones.
Russian officials and airline executives are at odds over what caused a Russian airliner to crash in Egypt over the weekend. A member of the committee analyzing the flight recorders says the jet broke up on its own due to some kind of mechanical failure. But earlier today, an executive from the airline chalked up the crash to an external influence. An ISIS-affiliated group has claimed responsibility for bringing down the plane with more than 220 people on board. You're listening to USA Radio News. I'm Melody Burkett.
Good morning, Hunterdon. This is Big C coming to you from HuntertonChamberRadio.com at the studio offices of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce in Flemington, New Jersey. Good morning, Hunterdon kicks off your day by providing you with local news, traffic, and weather, as well as light topics through Vitamin C, Wake Up Call, and Chamber Chat. I also have many guests focusing on Hunterdon County community, business, and education. Listen to me every weekday morning from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Good Morning Hunterdon, HuntertonChamberRadio.com.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterton at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterton, the voice for mental health in Hunterton County. The weather this afternoon is going to be mostly sunny with a high near 67 with calm winds. Tonight will be patchy fogs after 4 a.m., otherwise mostly clear with a low around 42. Tuesday, patchy fog before 7 a.m., otherwise sunny with a high near 72, and calm winds becoming west around 5 miles an hour. Tuesday night, patchy fog after 5 a.m., otherwise it'll be clear with a low around 41. Wednesday will be patchy fog before 7 a.m., otherwise sunny with a high near 76. That's the way I like it. Calm winds. Wednesday night, a slight chance of showers after 1 a.m., patchy fog after 5, otherwise partly cloudy with a low around 45, and the chance of precipitation is 20%. This is the Hunterton County Chamber Radio, and it's the Hunterton Medical Center's hour on the radio. I am Larry Cartwright, your host, and we're very privileged today to have with us Dr. Javier Torrens, who is a doctor with the Center for Endocrine Health. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
First of all, what is endocrine health?
Well, what endocrinology is it's a specialty that talks about all the glands in the body.
Okay.
So there are many different glands in the body, going from the pituitary to the thyroid, mm-hmm. parathyroid glands, adrenal glands. And what our goal is to try to make sure that your systems are all in balance, so your hormones basically are all in tune, making sure that you're doing well from that perspective.
Okay. I ask most guests, just about all the guests actually, it's just a fetish of mine basically, how they got into doing this. Some people say it was because, you know, someone in their family had an illness and they got this, or someone had this and that's why they became a police officer, or whatever the case may be. I was just curious, what was your reason for A, becoming a doctor, and second, getting into this type of, you know, research and work?
So it's basically a family experience. I was around 5 years old. And my grandfather was crossing the street, and unfortunately he got hit by a motorcycle. And he basically became a vegetable, pretty much. This is back many years ago. And back then, they didn't have all the beds or the technology that we have, so my grandmother basically took care of my grandfather for many years, all by herself. And, you know, I remember hiding underneath the bed when the doctors used to come by to see him in the hospital, because, you know, when you're that young, you're not supposed to be in the hospital anyway.
Right.
So I figured, you know, I saw how much grief she had and how much pain she went through and everything else, and I wanted to do something to try to see if I could help him. But unfortunately, there was nothing that can be done. So she took care of him for a very long time, and I learned a lot about from her in terms of, you know, taking care of people and making sure that you do what you can to try to help those who are in need. So that's sort of why I became a doctor. Originally, I wanted to become a neurosurgeon, but I'm like, it's too much. But over time, I sort of learned a few things and some of the basics. And the one thing I always like to solve is puzzles. And endocrinology pretty much has to do with a puzzle. The body has hormones that pretty much are supposed to work in a certain way. And when they're not working a certain way, it creates a series of disorders.
Okay.
And basically, if you understand how the normal physiology is, then you can sort of figure out how to fix the problem. So endocrinology has to do a lot of with hormones and how they're off. And one of the things we actually deal with on our day-to-day basis is diabetes.
Okay. Yeah, I just find it interesting, you know, how people got into their line of work. And, you know, I can appreciate your grandmother. I mean, because you're going back years ago now.
I'm not saying that you're that old, but it's a few years back, and they didn't have the technology they do now. They didn't have the services they do now. And so your grandmother was pretty much everything there. She was the whole thing, right?
Right. He had to have a bed sore. He used to change him every 2 hours, turn him over.
Right,
in the bed and everything else. And he lived for like 40 years like that.
Wow.
She was a strong woman. And
absolutely.
Yeah, she never took a day off. Anytime she wanted to go out, she would feel bad. And, near the end, she couldn't take care of him anymore. And, he sort of succumbed to an infection, but that was a long time.
Yeah, that was, God bless her,
Yeah, I learned a lot from her. And, she'd tell me, always listen to your patients because they know the disease better than anybody else. And always treat them with respect, because if you don't, you're not really going to help anybody.
And I would believe that's pretty much true.
Yep.
Some patients elaborate or, add things that aren't really there. But most, I think, they're the ones feeling the pain, or they're the ones feeling the problems and so on and so forth. And I would imagine it's kind of difficult to diagnose just from listening to them,
Well, sometimes they just want to talk.
Okay.
Sometimes you sort of have to sort out what's going on with them, and you basically have to sort of filter out what's good, what's important, what's not important. And the thing about medicine is this: medicine's not an art, medicine's not a science, it's a humbling experience. So you really need to be able to pay attention to what they're saying to sort of sort out. But you're right, you have some patients who go on and on, but you have to be able to sort out what's important and what's not from what they're saying. But with endocrinology, there's certain specific things that we can look for and ask that actually help us sort of cut to the chase in some cases.
Okay. So you're basically dealing with diabetes, and it's my understanding you have type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes. What is the difference between them?
So I'd say about 50% of what we do has to do with diabetes. The other is 30% is thyroid. The other rest, 20% is everything else.
Okay.
So we basically try to split diabetes in type 1 and type 2. We used to call it juvenile diabetes or type 1 diabetes. And type 2 diabetes is what we consider to be old adult onset diabetes. But basically, it really boils down to insulin. So in people who have type 1 diabetes, tend to be insulin deficient. In other words, they're required to be on insulin to sustain life. Without it, they get very sick very quickly, and they will ultimately die. Type 2 diabetes is a little bit different. Patients tend to make insulin. It's just that the insulin that they're making is not enough to be able to keep the sugars under control. And over time, the sugar tends to go higher, and that's what basically pretty much gets them into problems. So type 1 diabetes is an insulin-deficient state. Type 2 diabetes is what we call an insulin-resistant state. So whatever insulin that you have is not working the way it should, so that's why your sugar is higher. Now, people who have type 2 diabetes for long enough, let's say you've had diabetes for about 15, 20 years, eventually not only does the insulin that you have doesn't work very well, but your body eventually stops making insulin. So you have an older person who has type 2 diabetes who has to be on insulin. So just to keep it simple, type 1 diabetes, you need to be on insulin to sustain life. In type 2 diabetes, the insulin that you have is not working very well.
Okay. Is diabetes hereditary?
That's a great question. Let's split it into the type 2s and the type 1s. So if you have somebody who has type 1 diabetes, the risk of having a child with type 1 diabetes is greater than that of the general population. However, when you look at the total risk, if you're a man, the risk is 6% likelihood of your child will develop type 1 diabetes. If you're a woman, it's around 3%. Those numbers look very small, but when you look at the general population, where 0.5% of the people develop type 1 diabetes, what we call the relative risk is a lot higher, but the absolute risks tend to be smaller. So in people who have type 2 diabetes, that is much higher.
Okay.
Usually between 30 to 50% of the patients who have a parent who has type 2 diabetes, they actually develop it. And it also has to do not so much with a genetic predisposition, in other words, with the genes they got from the parents, but what environmental exposure they're exposed to. In other words, diet, weight, lack of exercise, other things that actually can put those patients at risk.
I asked that because, well, first of all, my wife's brother was a diabetic. He has since passed away, but, and her sister's husband is a diabetic since he was like 6 years old. Right. And he's, 75, 76 now. But he has, his two sons developed diabetes very late in life. Like his oldest son was 50 or 48 or 49 when he got it. And then there's the other son was closer to 50 when he got it. I mean, they're handling it. They're doing it. They're doing everything they're supposed to do for it. And, you know, but it's just, you know, I just was curious if it was, you know, so, hereditary or what.
Right. Know? So from what you're telling me, if I get it correct, if he was diagnosed when he was around 5-6 years old and he's now in his 70s, he has type 1 diabetes and he's been very fortunate to live this long, which is a testament to his care. And the thing about children is that half the genes are from the father, the other half the genes are from the mother. So it sounds to me like his two children develop what we consider to be type 2 diabetes. So there's no data that I'm aware of out there that if you have type 1 diabetes, you're at high risk of developing type 2. But I bet you that predisposition to developing the type 2 diabetes that his children have probably came from the mother's side of the family rather than from him.
And the mother's side, her brother had it.
Correct.
So, yeah. And I know from experience, my wife's brother, for many years, you know, drank, he smoked, you know, partied, didn't follow what he was supposed to, and, you know, paid a price for it. You know, he lost part of his leg, and they had to amputate part of his leg. And, you know, he was, who knows, maybe he would have lasted longer in life if he would have taken care of himself better. I don't know, but it just, you know, who knows? I mean, that's a guess, you know, but it just seems that, you know, and I remember him because I remember when I was, you know, dating his sister, my wife, you know, he was just a party animal, you know, and never ate the right foods, never, you know, so.
So he, his genes saved him. Unfortunately, all the things that he was doing wasn't necessarily the best for him. So.
No, not at all. you know, they weren't the best for any of us.
Back then, you know, you smoked, you drank, you didn't know any better,
exactly.
You know?
Right, exactly. I have to ask, is there a thing called, like, pre-diabetes?
Yes.
Because some doctors have said, no, there isn't. You're either diabetic or you're not. And, you know, I know that people have said that they're pre-diabetic.
Right.
But the doctors have told them that.
So when you think about type 2 diabetes, so people have type 1 diabetes, they get diabetes and usually pretty present very quickly. Sugars are really high, they get really symptomatic, they're very sick, they go to the emergency room. And people have type 2 diabetes tend to present a little bit differently. So, you know, being diabetic is like being pregnant. Either you're pregnant or you're not. However, in people who have type 2 diabetes, they actually can get problems with your sugar that start before you actually start having the numbers come up, per se. So you have to think about type 2 diabetes like you're on this railroad tracks. You have metabolic disease. So we always think about the sugar, but we tend to forget what everything else really talks about. So what metabolic disease has to do with obesity, blood pressure, cholesterol. A lot of these things will start to change before the sugar tends to go up. So typically when we diagnose type 2 diabetes, you have to have a fasting glucose more than 126. A normal individual, we have a glucose level of less than 100. So you have a whole bunch of people in the middle between 101 and 125. So these people would be considered to be pre-diabetic. What that basically means is that they don't have diabetes yet. But the risk of developing diabetes over 5 years is between 25 and 50%. So eventually, those patients, a large percentage of them, will actually develop diabetes. So what that prediabetes means is the following. It doesn't mean that you have diabetes yet, as it pertains to sugar elevations, but you're showing all the signs and symptoms of what we consider to be metabolic disease. In other words, what happens before your sugar starts to go higher. And although people can think about prediabetes, well, I don't have diabetes, you don't have to worry about it. What happens is those patients tend to be at a much higher risk of having cardiovascular events, heart attacks, strokes, peripheral vascular disease, and everything else. It's not uncommon for us to get called to see a patient in a coronary care unit after having a heart attack or a stroke, and that's the first time they find out if they have diabetes. So all of this is happening before. So think about prediabetes, not so much of like my sugar's high, where I'm going to develop diabetes. Think about it more in terms of metabolic disease. In other words, you have predisposition, you're on these railroad tracks that if you continue further, you will either have a heart attack or a stroke first, or you'll develop diabetes first. It all depends on your body's ability to make insulin. So if your body can make lots of insulin, you will be pre-diabetic for a very long time, but because you have this underlying metabolic disorders with the blood pressure, cholesterol, and everything else, you're more likely to get heart disease first. Typically, you see that in African Americans. People who don't really or cannot make a lot of insulin, like you see that in Asians, what will happen is those patients develop diabetes first, with the sugar being high, and then down the road, they'll develop the cardiovascular disease.
If you're told you're pre-diabetic, is there a medication they give you to help you get through this, and along with exercising and eating properly? And
so the diabetes prevention trial that was done many years ago tried to answer that question. So what they did was they took patients who were considered to be high risk of diabetes, they were all pre-diabetic, and they put them on a medication called metformin. Mm-hmm. It works really well. And they actually looked at patients over time. They actually found that by taking the metformin, it decreased the risk of developing diabetes between 30 to 35%. Now, the control group was patients who actually were treated with diet and exercise, and their goal was to lose at least 10% of the body weight. They were only able to lose 7% of the body weight. At the end, you were able to decrease the risk of developing diabetes by about 65%. There is no question that medication can help you prevent the development of diabetes, but diet and exercise, particularly if you're high risk, if you lose 7% of your body weight, is twice as good as metformin. Since then, other medications have been currently tested for that to prevent diabetes, and there are many medications out there. But if you really look at it from a overall perspective, what we're trying to treat is not so much a sugar number, we're trying to treat metabolic disease. And if you really want to treat the underlying problem that actually leads to the cardiovascular disease, you know, it's fine to have numbers that are good, but ultimately I want you to live longer. There's no prospective, randomized control clinical trial that has ever demonstrated that tight glycemic control in people who have type 2 diabetes can actually make you live longer. If you diet and exercise, you do much better. So it's not so much about the sugar, it's all about prevention. And diet and exercise beats any drug anytime.
Okay. That's interesting. I got to tell you, they've told me, I don't know, I want to say about 7 years ago, I was pre-diabetic. So when this subject came up, I said, oh, I love this. I want to talk about it. I am on metformin, but I do go to the gym.
Right.
I have lost weight. I'm still in the process of attempting to lose more weight. It's not as easy for us overly large people. Of course, I just recently spent 10 days in the hospital and lost like 15 pounds. So wow. That'll do her, because when I was in the hospital, they had me on a diabetic type thing, prick my finger before each meal that jazz, which I don't do. I don't, test for sugar now, because they told me I didn't have to. But they had me on, so we are attempting, my wife and I are attempting to, smaller portions and watch what we eat and, but like I said, I do exercise. I try to go to the gym 3 to 4 times a week. And You know, yeah. So.
If it were easy, I wouldn't have a job. It's very difficult. And, you know, we're used to eating certain things for such a long time, and our habits are very difficult to change, and we get used to eating certain things. And it basically, you know, how they used to say it takes a village to take care of a, raise a child? Well, it takes a village to take care of a diabetic. Because you have to realize, or somebody's got prediabetes, it doesn't only affect you, it affects everybody in your house. So let's say that, you know, obviously your children are probably out of the house by now.
Yeah,
But you have somebody who is, you know, let's say they're pre-diabetic, who are in their mid-50s, who have young children at home, whose wife is, you know, cooking whatever, and the husband is the one who has to deal with it, it affects the entire family.
Sure.
Or even if it's the wife, you know. So it's difficult to change dietary habits, and it's basically, it's a continuous process. It's not like you start from point A to point B. The goal is not to basically lose the weight and get better, but to change your behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Because behavior modification is what's the most important thing.
Yeah. I keep trying.
Yeah, you know, if it were easy, it would not be, you know, I wouldn't have a job. But it really, from a physician's perspective, you need to have a team of people. So pre-diabetics are a little bit different diabetics, but from the diabetes perspective, we always think about the dietitian. We always have a diabetes educator. And ideally, you like to have what we call a health coach or somebody who's going to help you maintain that weight loss mm-hmm. that you need. And that's something that can be tricky sometimes.
Yeah, because when I was in the hospital, I had a dietitian come and speak to me. And she said that, you know, I can come with my wife anytime and just call her and, you know, she would go over some things. And
yeah. I mean, that's all very nice and very helpful in the artificial environment, but when the rubber meets the road, let's see, you're watching TV, you're watching the Super Bowl, you're watching a game or whatever, you see all these ads for all this food. You know, they're putting those ads on TV just to be nice, but to make money and just basically create certain appetites. And you try to be good, and then you start getting this craving, and it becomes a problem.
Or you see a Mets lose.
That was discouraging.
It was very discouraging because I've been a Mets fan for a long time. But anyway, what are the steps to diagnose type 1 as opposed to type 2 diabetes?
So type 1 diabetics usually present out of the blue. They usually don't necessarily have a family history. So there's no specific screening test. You actually can go to your doctor. Hey, doctor, please test me for type 1 diabetes. If you're coming in off the get-go with no family history or anything else like that. If, let's say, your mother or your father has type 1 diabetes and you're worried about developing type 1 diabetes and you look healthy and fit, there's some lab tests you actually can do to look for evidence of autoimmune diabetes. So there are a series of 4 or 5 different lab tests you actually can measure to see what your risk is. If you get 2 out of 5, your risk of developing diabetes over a 10-year period tends to be 2 to 5%, which is much higher. Mm-hmm. And it's just a matter of keeping an eye on that. Again, everybody's a little bit different. They're not recommending screening people with type 1 diabetes unless they're enrolled in some type of clinical trial. But if the patient's worried about it and I do the antibodies when they come to see me in the office and they come back negative, it doesn't rule it out. But it basically tells them at the present time, you're okay. If they come back positive, it tells them, well, you're a higher risk. You have 2 of them. We have to be more careful in terms of making sure we monitor you. For people who have type 2 diabetes, it tends to be a little bit different. The guidelines are constantly changing. If you're overweight with a BMI of 25 kilograms per meter squared or greater, they're saying that you should be screened at least every 3 years with a fasting glucose level, or you can get this test called a hemoglobin A1C. If that comes back negative, you can follow it. Because the prevalence of diabetes is so high in our country, once you get above 45, irrespective of your ethnic group or anything else, or whether you're overweight or not, you should be screened. And again, it's just a matter of talking to your primary care provider. Certain groups tend to be at a much higher risk. So let's say that you're African-American or Hispanic, you're overweight, you have high blood pressure, your cholesterol is high, and your waist is large, then you're much higher risk than somebody who's Caucasian, who has no family history, who has normal blood pressure, normal cholesterol, normal everything else. So you basically have to sort of see where you're at. And the ultimate test is your family history. So obviously, if you have a family history of type 2 diabetes, you've got to be proactive mm-hmm. in terms of trying to make sure that not only do you check for the sugar problem, but you also make sure that you don't develop the metabolic disease that comes from the weight gain.
Right. And that's difficult if you are not sure of your family history.
Correct. Sometimes we see patients who are adopted, or, you know, not every family talks to everybody, as we'll find out soon when Thanksgiving comes around, depending who's sitting on the right and the left, right?
Exactly.
So, and sometimes families don't want to talk about it. So if you do not know and you're not sure, you can always check with your primary care provider. You know, they can check some screening blood tests looking for your cholesterol, specifically paying attention to the good cholesterol, which is HDL, looking at the simple fats called triglycerides. Those are the two most important ones. If those come back normal, if you have no blood pressure issues and your routine blood test looks fine, your risk is smaller than if somebody comes up with those values that are much higher.
Right.
The other thing, it has to do with your weight and waist circumference. So if you have a waist circumference more than 38 inches, your risk is much higher than if it's not.
Okay. I'm working on it.
Yeah.
I am, really.
It's not simple. It's hard. And, you know, we as doctors sometimes tell the patients, well, you know, you exercise more and eat more and eat less. It's difficult, you know, and even for people who have type 1 diabetes who have to do that, it's not that simple.
Well, I had both my knees replaced 5 years ago, and I lost 60 pounds prior to having them replaced because they told me that I was way overweight and I shouldn't have it done until I lost some weight. And like I said, now I've lost weight again, and I'm down to, I don't know, 248 now. So I'm trying to, you know, knock it down a little more. Yeah. But, you know, I don't know if you find this to be true in some patients, but you hit like a level, mm-hmm. and it's like there it sits. You know, you go up a pound, you get down a pound, you know, and that's you sort of like stay there for a period of time. And, you know, you feel like hitting the wall, you know, because it's like so frustrating, you know, because you're trying and it doesn't do anything. You know?
Yeah, actually, that's something that doctors have told the patients, well, listen, you know, exercising enough, you know, doing all the right things. What you have to realize is that sometimes your body turns on genes to prevent you from losing any further weight because of you have a genetic predisposition to that. Before coming into clinical practice, I did research over at the Rockefeller. We were actually looking at the obesity genes, and we looked at mice that lost a lot of weight and basically looked at mice who were fed that small amount of food that these other mice that were losing weight were eating. And some of them did not lose any weight, and actually basically pretty much there were genes that were being turned on. There's a new thought in the community out there. There's some literature out there to support this that actually just got presented at the Endocrine Society meeting this past summer, actually in the spring, that actually looked at exercise resistance. What that basically means is that you have patients who exercise and do not lose weight. And that's something that's a new concept that is currently being investigated. So although the majority of the patients do try their hardest and do their best, sometimes their body may not necessarily get them there. However, that's what I consider to be a diagnosis of exclusion. In other words, you have to make sure that we do everything else to make sure there's not something else going on.
Right. Yeah. How does the body control the sugar?
So it's insulin. Let's take a step back. Your sugar is controlled by four main hormones. You have glucagon that makes your sugar go up, epinephrine, and cortisol. All those four hormones make your sugar go up. Insulin makes your sugar go down. So if you have a problem with any of those four hormones, you actually have problems with sugar. The main thing that we actually talk about is basically insulin. And that's what I'm going to be talking about next because that affects 99% of the patients. So insulin, think about it like a key. If you lose your key, can you get in your house? Can you get your car in your car? No. So insulin is the key that allows sugar to get into your body, right? So if your body doesn't make any insulin, like people with type 1 diabetes, pretty much your sugar tends to go up. That's why you need to be an insulin. People have type 2 diabetes. They have a key that doesn't work very well. the other thing that people have type 2 diabetes is that not only do they have problems with insulin, the body tends to release too much of a hormone called glucagon inappropriately, and that tends to go higher. It also tends to, the fat tends to get deposited in places it shouldn't get deposited because of metabolic disease, tends to be deposited in the liver, tends to be deposited in the muscle, and that makes the insulin's job even harder. The other thing that actually happens is that the brain's ability to control glucose is also affected. In addition to the problems with not only having the insulin work well, like I mentioned before, over time, your body's ability to make insulin is not as good. So although we think about the management of type 1 diabetes just being with insulin, the management of type 2 diabetes is basically dealing with trying to get the insulin that the patients have to work better, and then see whether all these other dysregulatory effects can be corrected. The most important thing is to get that insulin to work better in somebody's got type 2 diabetes, and that's the top three things are weight loss. Because when you lose the weight, that fat that's in your liver goes away. That fat that's in your muscle goes away. So that helps the insulin that your body's making work even better. The other thing is that the pancreas doesn't have to work as hard to make insulin to get your sugar under better control.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, we always talk about trying to get your sugar under control, but we tend to forget about treating metabolic disease. And the metabolic disease is what makes the sugar not work so well. So if you treat that by getting rid of the fat in the muscle, getting rid of the fat in the liver, and you lose some weight, it helps your body release the insulin better.
And exercising can help you lose weight if you watch what you eat. Is that correct?
Exercise can help you lose weight if you watch what you eat. That is correct.
Okay. Yeah.
If you don't watch what you eat, you can exercise all you want, and you're not going to lose the weight. So that's the other thing that people tend to do. You know, they exercise a whole bunch. They don't really realize that they're not really burning as many calories as they think they're burning. And they basically tend to eat. Worst of all, they tend to drink all those calories back, either through juice or energy drinks or something else. And you're basically defeating a purpose there.
Well, I don't drink energy drinks.
But, you know,
some people do, but I don't. I never did. Water or iced tea, and, you know, one large cup of coffee in the morning, and that's it.
Oh, well, that's pretty good. But unfortunately, you know, you see all these ads for all these Gatorades and all these Powerades and all these other drinks. There's a lot of sugar in there.
Sure.
And even, you know, the wellness centers, or not the wellness centers, but the gyms, some of them will have, you know, places where you can get a smoothie or something else.
Mm-hmm.
Very good, healthy drinks. But there's calories in all that.
Sure, sure.
So something to keep in mind.
Yeah, the Health and Wellness on 31 just recently opened up a, what do you call it, snack bar type thing there.
I mean, you know, you can get some great nutrition from fruit. You can get some great nutrition with other things.
Absolutely.
But if you're going to exercise 500 calories off, and you're going to drink 500 calories, it sort of defeats the purpose.
Exactly. Now, you touched on that your type 1 and type 2 diabetes is treated differently.
Correct.
Is there problems that can be caused by having either one that has to be treated? Or
so when we talk about diabetes, we talk about elevated sugars and complications from that. So you have two types of complications. You have what we call the microvascular complications, that has to do with little blood vessels in your body. Mm-hmm. And your macrovascular complications have to do with large vessels. So both people with type 1 and type 2 diabetes can get problems with the small vessels and the large vessels. So let's talk about the small vessels, which is basically the small vessels in the eyes, in the kidneys, in the nervous system. So if your sugar tends to be too high for too long, what you will actually happen is that you start having problems with your eyes, which is we always tell our patients who have diabetes to get their eyes screened to make sure that they have no problems inside the eye, because the most common symptom of eye disease in people who have type 1 or type 2 diabetes is nothing. You can be fine, all of a sudden you don't really realize you have a lot of diabetes inside your eye, because what happens to blood vessels basically tend to grow too fast because the retina, which is the part of the eye that allows you to see, think of it like the film on the camera, doesn't get enough oxygen. So when it doesn't get enough oxygen, it says, well, listen, wait a second. I need to get blood vessels here. So in a rush, the body makes blood vessels to get to the eye to feed the retina. When it makes blood vessels that are somewhat not as strong, predisposed to bleeding. When you have the small vessels in the eyes, the small vessels in the kidneys can be affected. And the kidney's job is to basically filter your blood to make sure the filtering of your blood is maintained clean. So the filter starts to get clogged. And when it starts to get clogged, it doesn't really filter the blood very well. And people can get kidney disease from that perspective. When the small vessels in the nerves are affected, people will start complaining of numbness in the hands and the feet, typically in the feet first because of the longest nerves, subsequently the hands. Typically, they can have two symptoms, either numbness, or classically, they may develop pain in their leg. Okay. They feel like they have ants crawling up their leg, or they feel like they're walking on glass. Or one of the common things that people complain of, they feel like they have a sock rolled up in their foot. So that basically deals with the macrovascular complications that can happen either type 1 or type 2 diabetes. The fortunate thing is that we can prevent those complications by improving the sugar control in both type 1 and type 2 diabetics. So if you control your sugar, you can prevent the progression of disease that's already established, and you actually can slow the development of any of these complications from happening. So we always advocate tight glycemic control, in other words, getting your sugar under better control for people who have type 1 and type 2 diabetes. The interesting thing is the following. When you think about people with type 1 diabetes, when you control the sugar very tightly, not only does it decrease the risk of having complications in the eyes, the kidneys, and the hands, and the feet, the nervous system, but also can decrease the risk of them from dying from a heart attack between 30 to 50%. It's pretty significant.
It is pretty significant.
Right. So in people who have type 2 diabetes, it tends to be not only do we worry about the microvascular complications, but we also worry about the macrovascular complications, the big blood vessels, and that has to do with strokes, heart disease, peripheral vascular disease in the legs and everything else. So although sugar control is important, it's not the only thing that we have to worry about. In that particular setting, you have to worry about cholesterol, blood pressure. So we think about treating, make sure your blood pressure, cholesterol, or sugar are well controlled, particularly in people who have type 2 diabetes, because we know in those patients, controlling sugar by itself is not going to prevent them from having a macrovascular event, heart disease, stroke, or peripheral vascular disease. You have to treat all three, and that's extremely important.
How you had said about getting your eye examined.
Right.
How often would you have to do this? Once a year? Once every 6 months?
So in terms of the eyes exam, if you're newly diagnosed type 1 diabetes, you have a little bit of time. But usually, if you have known disease, you have to talk to your ophthalmologist to basically find out where you're at. If you have disease that's well controlled and your eyes are not affected by the diabetes, people would say every once or 2 years, make sure you get your eyes examined. Currently, there's a big debate about what the screening should be, but going at least once a year will keep your nose clean. If you have active eye disease, it may be every 6 months or every 3 months that you'll see the eye doctor, but for routine screening, at least once a year, for sure.
Okay. I was just curious because I go once a year anyway,
Right.
But, I just...
Yeah, most people do go once a year. The unfortunate thing is not everybody usually does that. Sometimes people push it out to 2 years, which, depending on the right clinical setting, that may be appropriate. Again, you have to talk to your doctor about that. But, it's just a matter of keeping an eye on that. And glycemic control is very important to make sure that the eyes are not affected.
Now, is there sort of tests or exams that are done to diagnose any issues?
So in terms of the microvascular complications, which is the small vessels, the best way to see what's going on in your eyes is to go see an eye doctor so they can actually take a look inside.
Right.
To see what's going on in your kidneys, there are two tests that we usually do. One of them is a blood test, and the other one is a urine test. So the simplest way to think about it is this. The urine test is the smoke detector in your house. It's going to show up before you can see the flames. So we always do a urine test looking for what we call microalbumin. What that basically means is that when the kidneys start getting affected by the diabetes and the filters start to get clogged, what your body's supposed to hold on to, it actually, instead of being held on to, it actually starts to spill. You will actually start seeing problems there about 3 to 5 years before you actually see any problems in the blood. The blood tests are very helpful. They're actually in addition to the urine tests, but by the time you actually start seeing the problems in the blood, the kidneys have been affected for a while. So we always do the urine test, always do the blood test. For the nerves, clinical history is extremely important. Are you having any burning, numbness, tingling before you go to bed? Do your feet start bothering you before you put the sheets on? Or are your legs numb? You can ask the patient those questions, but on a physical exam, we always do two things. We look at the patient's feet looking for circulation. We look at how well the skin is looking. We're looking for hair, because hairy toes tell me you have good circulation, okay? And the other thing that I actually do is what we call a monofilament test. But that basically is a test where you take a little filament that under 10 grams of pressure will bend. So we'll basically see if you feel that with your toe. And basically that's going to tell me what you have, what we call protective sensation. In other words, you can feel if you have a little something in your shoe or something, or a pebble on your foot. The other thing you actually test for is vibration with a tuning fork. And that basically tests two different parts of your nervous system.
Okay.
And we always do both. If you lose protective sensation, that's the pinprick, you're at much higher risk of developing an ulcer in your feet. Often, people will lose vibration sensation first before they lose the pinprick sensation. Hmm. So the vibration is the earlier sign. Hmm. The most important thing is make sure we look at your feet and everything. In terms of the heart, we always ask the patients whether they're having any chest pain, shortness of breath. Sometimes people have diabetes, don't have any discomfort in the chest. They'll complain, well, I just get tired when I'm walking, or I just get short of breath when I go up a flight of steps. So basically, it boils down to clinical history and pretty much doing an EKG to make sure that the electricity in the heart is doing okay. Those are pretty much the main things that we actually test for when the patients come to see us. For complications, for micro or macrovascular complications.
Well, some of the things you said, my general practitioner does when I go for my physical.
Yep.
You know, in fact, a lot of what you said that he does. You know, and should someone say like me, come to your organization in addition to the general practitioner?
Right. So I can tell you there are a lot of great primary care providers in Hunterdon County. Most of them are very good. They know what they're doing, and they keep their patients very well under control. And there are a lot of patients with type 2 diabetes. They're more diabetics than we have endocrinologists. And as long as you're getting to your target A1C, as long as your blood pressure is well controlled, as long as your cholesterol is doing well, and as long as you think you're getting good care from your primary care provider, you don't necessarily need to see an endocrinologist. If you think that you're not getting the best of care, then you can always come see us. We'll say, hey, Larry, I think you're doing great care. I don't think you need to see me. You can go see me once a year if you want to make sure that everything's okay. And it's not often that I do that when the patients get referred to me or patients self-referred to me. I think you're doing great. Your doctor is doing all the right things. Your nurse practitioner is doing all the right things. Come see me once a year if you want to make sure that everything's okay. Some patients are not under well control. And if they feel frustrated because their primary care providers aren't listening to them or they don't think they're getting the care that they need, then come see us and then we come up with a plan and, you know, say, you know, I think your primary care provider was doing the right things. Maybe he didn't explain him to you the way that we explain him to you, which gives you a different perspective. And sometimes we'll see patients once, twice, send them back to their primary care provider for better understanding. Sometimes the primary care provider is trying their hardest, doing their best, and you're not getting to your targets, and either you make that decision or the primary care provider makes that decision. Not everybody who has diabetes needs to come see us. But if you don't think you're getting the care that you need, then you can always come anytime you want. The most important thing is basically the patient needs to understand their disease. There is no substitute for a diabetes education and nutrition education, because the person who takes care of the diabetes is not me, the endocrinologist, is not the patient's primary care provider, is not the patient's spouse, significant other, is the patient. So you need to really understand what's going on with your disease to really basically get an idea of whether or not you need to come see me or not. Because if you don't understand your disease and you've seen your primary care provider, who may be very nice, you don't know whether you're really getting what you need. It sounds to me like you're getting all the appropriate care, but I think that the bottom line is this. The person who takes care of your diabetes is the patient. You need to educate yourself to know whether or not you're getting what you need. If you don't think you're getting what you need, we'd be more happy to see you. If you are a patient, I mean, if you don't think you're getting it, or your primary care provider can get you where you need to be, then we're more happy to see you.
Okay. Are there any warning signs that people can look for to know if they're on the track for either type 1 or type 2 diabetes?
So,
or that they should get tested for?
So classic symptoms are, you know, drinking a lot of water, urinating a lot, losing a lot of weight. Unfortunately, only about 20 to 30% of the people who actually do have diabetes come present with those classic symptoms. Most of the time, they have a family history, or they go see the doctor and they say, geez, I lost 40 pounds. And all of a sudden, they go see the doctor. Sometimes people have no symptoms, but if you're having tingling in the hands of the feet, weight loss, drinking a lot of water, urinating a lot, those are pretty classic symptoms that are basically suggestive you need to go see somebody right away. But the most important thing is if you have family history, you really should just need to get screened, because the most common symptom is nothing.
You're going to urinate a lot if you're on a water pill, though.
Correct. Okay, so that becomes an important question. So the question I ask my patients is the following. Well, you know, doc, I drink a lot of water. Okay. Are you getting up at night to urinate? If you tell me, doc, I'm going to, you know, getting up 3, 4, 5 times at night to drink, to urinate, and then I'm really thirsty, I have to drink water. If you're on a water pill and you take the water pill in the morning, you urinate during the day, if you're still getting up at night, you have a problem. Okay?
Even if you're getting up like once or twice?
Once, you know, as you get older, most patients will maybe go once or twice, but I can tell you.
That's me, I'm older.
Right, well, you know. But I can tell you, if you're getting a water pill, you're seeing a primary care provider, and that doctor or primary care provider is actually checking your sugar at least. So if you develop sugars that are a little bit higher, that's going to show up in the blood test first before you're still having what we call the nocturia per se. Weight loss, if you lose more than, you know, 10% of your body weight pretty quickly and you're not trying to lose weight, that's a problem. That's mostly for type 2 diabetics. For type 1 diabetes, usually it comes very quickly. People are very sick. Most of the time they just end up in the emergency room very quickly. Mm. Fatigue, tiredness, I just don't feel well. Sometimes they'll just present like that.
When somebody comes to you and you do all your tests and such, and you come to the conclusion that they either have, well, let's say type 2 diabetes, what do they do so that they can help manage it?
So the first question I ask my patients is, how long do they have the disease? The next question I ask them, when was the last time you saw a dietitian? When was the last time you saw a diabetes educator? Because quite honestly, that's where it all starts. Because the person who takes care of the disease is the patient, not the doctor. So the first and most important thing, get diabetes education, get to see a dietitian. And most of the time, I'll tell my patients to check their sugar. It all depends on whether they're on insulin or not. If they're on insulin, they check their sugar more frequently. If they're not on insulin, depending on which medication they're on, I tell them to check it at least once a day to do two things. One of them is to basically make sure that their sugar is not going too high. The other thing is I use it like a teaching tool. And I usually tell my patients to check your sugar once a day before breakfast, one day before lunch, one day before dinner, one day before they go to bed. So they're only checking the sugar once a day, but they're checking it throughout the day. The main reason being is the following. You can actually see whether what you have for breakfast, what you have for lunch, what you have for dinner, or that dessert that you had, how it affected your sugar. Because it really is a matter of trying to make sure you fine-tune yourself in order to make sure you get to the target where you need to be. So I always tell them to check their sugar. If they tell me, Doc, it hurts too much, I can't afford it, then, you know, we come up with an individualized plan to, depending on where the patients are at.
Because I know when I was in the hospital, they did it before breakfast, before lunch, before dinner, and before going to bed.
Right.
And every time they did it, I was in there for 10 days. Every time they did it, they said it was great. So,
well, you're fortunate. And the main reason being is that when people are in the hospital, it tends things to be a little bit different. Sometimes the medications that we give you can make your sugar go high. Mm. Sometimes acute stress and acute illness. Remember I told you about cortisol,
right.
Epinephrine?
Right.
Those hormones tend to go up, and that can make your sugar go higher. The main reason we always check so frequently in the hospital is two things. Sometimes the medications we give you can make your sugar go low. The other thing is that if your sugar is running high, we need to make sure that we treat it, because if your sugar is running high and you're there with an infection, your body's ability to fight the infection is not as good.
That was an infection, a urinary tract infection.
Yeah, and think about it like this. The white cells is what destroy bacteria and is what helps your body fight the infection. When your sugar is high, the white cells can't tell where the infection is, and they can't really do their job very well. So it's sort of like you drinking a six-pack in 10 minutes.
Mm.
You don't know where you're going. You don't know what's going on. So when your sugar's high, the white cells can't find the bacteria. And when they find it, they don't know what to do with them. So that's why it's important in terms of trying to get the sugar lower. So that's probably why they were checking your sugar so frequently.
Right. All right. If somebody wanted to reach out to you to get an appointment or something, is it the phone number or?
Yeah. They can call the Center for Endocrine Health. Our number is 908-735-3980. Again, 908-735-3980.
And where is it located? Is it in the hospital or?
It's basically, we have two offices. One of them is basically in Raritan.
Okay.
It's in Route 202 next to Char. The other one is basically in the Clinton Wellness Center on 31.
Oh, okay.
Which is right up where that wellness center is.
Right.
So that's our two offices. We're there 5 days a week. So it's by appointment.
Okay, doctor, I can't tell you how great it's been speaking to you, and I really appreciate you coming. And who knows, maybe one day I'll see you.
Hopefully not, because I tend to run really early in the morning. So it's a pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
It's been wonderful, and I really, you know, I've learned some things, and I hope that people out there have also. Okay?
All right.
Dr. Torrens, it's, you know, again, just real quick, what's the phone number?
908-735-3980.
All right, and we'll be seeing you again next week, so enjoy yourself. And if you have any of the symptoms we talked about, make that phone call. See you next week.
This is USA Headline News. I'm Melody Burkett. Some Republican presidential hopefuls are looking for more input on how the remaining debates are run. However, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie tells Fox News' Fox and Friends he wants everyone to stop complaining.
Why are we spending time arguing and bickering about this? I'd rather spend my time going out there talking to voters and talking about issues that really matter to the country.
Representatives from 11 Republican campaigns met Sunday to talk about how to move forward after a lot of criticism of the way last week's CNBC debate was handled. An official with one of the campaigns tells Reuters that the campaigns will take a more active role in negotiating the format of debates with the networks that host them. A bill extending government funding for 2 years is a done deal. President Obama signed the bipartisan measure at the White House. The deal increases spending for defense and domestic programs and extends the federal debt limit until March of 2017. By that time, Obama's successor will be in the White House. You're listening to USA Radio News. I'm Melody Burkett.
Get your Plenty card at Exxon or Mobil and start earning points at lots of places.
So I get points for filling up at Exxon?
You sure do.
What about getting coffee at Mobil?
Points.
Streaming TV shows on Hulu?
Definitely.
Points on my AT&T wireless bill?
Yep.
Buying soap?
At Rite Aid.
Buying you a birthday present?
Points at Macy's.
Visiting your parents?
No. You get marriage points.
Oh.
Exxon and Mobil are the only fuel brands that are part of Plenty, the rewards program that lets you earn points at one place and use them at another. Join Plenty for free through a participating Exxon or Mobil station today. Terms and limitations apply. See Plenty.com/partners for details.
With a Sam's Club membership, you get incredible savings every time you shop. Sam's Club members get a savings book with over $5,500 in exclusive offers. Get set for the season with instant savings on kitchen favorites, like $3.50 off Chinette paper plates, $6 off Green Mountain Coffee K-Cups, and $3.30 off Reynolds Wrap Foil. Stop into Sam's Club or visit us online and get more for less this holiday with November